Welcome to Assembly Line, the podcast for entrepreneurs building on the Salesforce platform. We'll go behind the scenes with innovative founders and leaders to share their stories, strategies, and lessons to accelerate your own path to success as a Salesforce ISV. Are you struggling to make sense of the Salesforce security review? It's the number one roadblock slowing down your AppExchange launch. Security Review Partner translates those complex reports into a simple, prioritized checklist. Stop deciphering jargon and start shipping faster. Get the clear, step-by-step guidance you need to pass the review with confidence. Simplify your path to market. Visit securityreviewpartner.com today. That's securityreviewpartner.com. Hi there. So I'm joined today by Yella Van Guns, CEO of Sierra AI and two-time AppExchange founder. Welcome, Yella.
Hey, Scott. Thank you. Good to be here.
Great. So tell us a little bit about Sierra AI. What does the app do? Who is it for? And what problem does it solve?
Yeah, so Sierra AI is a set of AI agents for Salesforce admins and consultants. So we're helping to automate the grunt work, the stuff that takes a lot of time but doesn't really require a lot of thinking or expertise. So generating metadata, provisioning users, all those kind of basic admin steps that get in the way of actually serving the end customer and creating business value.
Giving admins back a lot of time, I'm sure that's much appreciated.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's our goal. You know, you shouldn't have to basically go into the Salesforce setup UI pretty much ever again once we get everything working.
Oh man! All right, that's a bold claim. I love that. All right, so give us an idea of your current state. What's current revenue, team size, customer count?
So we're still pretty early stage. We have a few pilot customers using the product. You know, a lot of people have expressed interest. We're working through like some of the final kinks to basically deliver on the vision that we're sketching out. So small team, like six people altogether. Me, VP sales, marketing agency, and advisor, and a couple offshore developers.
Cool. How did you first come up with the idea for Sierra AI?
So it actually came, you know, during the provisioning and deployment of customers for my previous company. You know, many times you'd see long delays, even for like simple configuration changes that had to be made. You know, weeks, sometimes months, just to get like a field added or the formula adjusted. People didn't really know what was in there. A lot of duplication, you know, technical debt, and teams essentially overwhelmed, just trying to keep the ship afloat and like unable to really process anything new. So that's really detracting from the value of Salesforce because you know, it becomes kind of a bottleneck rather than an enabler of agility, which it should be.
Right. I think a lot of people are probably nodding their heads right now listening to that. You mentioned this was born out of your other company, and I want to get to that in a minute, but this was decisions on demand that you're referring to, yes?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to chat with you about that in a moment, because I know that was also an AppExchange product and company with a successful story. So we're going to transition to that in a minute, but going back to Sierra AI, once you came up with the idea, how did you go about validating it in the market?
Yeah, so the first step is, you know, we send out some bulk emails to likely potential customers just to, you know, ask what they were experiencing, what the main issues were, you know, what the key pain points were that we could help them resolve. And that in parallel with some technical validation, you know, it's all based on underlying LLMs and you know, tool calling and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So we had to do a bunch of due diligence on you know, what is actually possible and what does it take to plug Salesforce into those LLMs successfully. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's obviously an ongoing thing because, you know, stuff is evolving so quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, once we kind of got the sense that you know, technically it would be feasible, then we could get to like really refining the use cases. And, you know, that's still an ongoing process. Like, you know, every time we talk to a customer, come across a real life use case, you know, there's more little edge cases that emerge And, you know, we're really trying to make sure that essentially almost all the time the experience is like, wow, the tool actually figured that out. And even if it didn't get it right the first time, it kind of auto-corrects, learns from the error message, and then tries something different and eventually gets it right. And that's a pretty magical experience when it does work.
Yeah.
Trying to get to as much as high a percentage as possible of those magical experiences.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So, and did you bootstrap Sierra AI, or did you go the fundraising route?
So far, it's bootstrapped. You know, with one small angel investor, and some suppliers and vendors that have kind of deferred some of their compensation for it. But we are going to be doing a fundraising round pretty soon, once we get our product fully launched and initial traction firmly established, then we'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Did you, and with your previous organization, Decisions on Demand, did you fundraise that for that venture as well, or was that bootstrapped?
No, that was fully bootstrapped. We had some revenue-based or revenue-backed debt at some point to help scale a little bit and smooth out some of the ebbs and flows, but no institutional funding.
So how did you, I know you said that to date you're still bootstrapped, but I'm curious, because I think this is a decision a lot of founders struggle with. How did you decide this go around that you're probably not going to go the bootstrapping route? Was it just about kind of the timing that bootstrapping would take?
Yeah, definitely. It's takes a lot more time, and right now there's a market opportunity that is very present, and the momentum is very critical.
Sure.
We felt that or I feel that right now the time is right to accelerate. You know, I think we have a product. It's not perfect yet, but it's getting very close to being a really really cool experience and very productive tool, and so we want to accelerate and double down on that, integrate it better into workflows, connect with Jira, Slack, etc., to really make it easy to use and fully integrated for people.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's smart too. Obviously, if you wait until it is perfect, you'll probably have missed the market opportunity. Right. So I think you're right to try and strike while the iron's hot. Well, I know Sierra is still early days, but I want to like pause and kind of pivot to talk a little bit about Decisions on Demand, because I think that's a really interesting story for folks to hear as well. So with Decisions on Demand, can you give a quick background of that as well? Like what problem that solution was solving and who it was for?
Yes. So initially it started out being a rules engine for Salesforce. So mm-hmm. I had a background in building business rules engines in a previous company that later got acquired by IBM. Not my company. It was a mid-sized company that I was an employee, early mm-hmm. employee for. So I tried to take that experience of a generic rules engine into the Salesforce ecosystem. So it turned out that that wasn't easy to sell. And this was, 13 years ago. So at the time, architectural, technology components, people couldn't really grasp that mostly.
Mm-hmm.
So they're really looking for specific point solutions. And it turns out that the point solution that people really gravitated towards was lead assignment. Right now, there's a lot of lead assignment vendors. At the time, there were not as many.
Sure. 2012 was a very different time to be building on not the platform entirely, but certainly AppExchange too.
Yeah, so we kind of listened to the customers and pivoted towards using the rules engine for that. So the underlying technology gave us some differentiation mm-hmm. in terms of being able to handle some fairly complicated use cases, we built a layer of specific capabilities around lead assignment and other types of assignment as well on top of that. So it turned out, ended up being a pretty flexible and powerful tool that people, embedded quite deeply into their workflows.
Great. Well, I know this is going back a long ways, but do you recall how you gained your early customers with Decisions on Demand?
Yeah, it was initially mainly through combination of like word of mouth, you know, going to events and stuff, and meeting people, as well as AppExchange. So, you know, we fairly quickly had a listing on the AppExchange, and at the time that was still productive. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it works the same way today, but you know, there weren't as many vendors, and so, you know, people would just kind of try out different solutions they found, and you know, through a combination of building some rapport and trust during initial calls, and you know, other capabilities, things that, you know, the flexibility I mentioned, that we had some differentiation against other vendors, so managed to land a bunch of companies, you know, initially smaller ones, but you know, we ended up signing some major insurance companies, you know, ADP, you know, Fortune 500 companies using the product.
Wow, that's a nice logo to have. And so you mentioned going to events. Is this Salesforce thrown events like Dreamforce, or were you? I'm trying to remember when the earliest community events started, the Dream and events.
Yeah, well, there were back then. Definitely, you know, a mix. Dreamforce, yes, but you know, it can be hard to meet the right people at Dreamforce because there's just so much going on.
Sure.
More productive is smaller events, you know, community meetings, just related meetups, even that doesn't have to be specifically Salesforce, but people with similar, you know, in a similar domain, sales ops related stuff. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that was useful, and it's also a good way to, you know, to meet people who can give you good feedback, and you know, through those connections, you know, a couple of customers came in that way, but mainly it was AppExchange, and later our website. You know, we had some success with content marketing. You know, it takes a long time to bear fruit, but when it does, sometimes it can be, you know, those are the better deals that come in that way.
That's great. So early days, AppExchange and the events, and then over time, some SEO and content marketing is what drove some of those larger deals, sounds like.
Yeah, so definitely the content marketing, if you put some effort into building like real collateral that actually tells a meaningful story and is kind of specific, not mm-hmm. just the buzzwords that are ranked highest on Google, but there are some very specific things. You know, we had good success because, you know, once people find that, if they're looking for that specific thing, you know, the traffic is not going to be high, but when people do find it and you tell pretty much exactly the story that they have in their head, that obviously immediately builds a bunch of trust, and you can, you know, based on that, kind of build a relationship as really an advisor, not just a tool vendor.
Sure.
So these are typically, you know, projects that will involve some consulting effort, and it's not like you know, just put in your credit card and sell it kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But they can be quite lucrative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the more you target, I'd say, your messaging, the narrower your audience, but maybe the better your conversion rate is going to be for folks that do that are in that market that you're targeting, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, because Salesforce has so many of these little areas, like, you know, territory management, you know, sure, not everybody uses it, but if they do, then it's a very specific thing, and many tools kind of out of the box don't fully support that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you do pretty much fully support that or offer a little bit of customization that makes it happen, then, you know, you can really solve a problem and be very sticky.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the AppExchange was great for lead gen. And I'm curious if there was anything you were doing specifically to try and optimize for that. I know there's the co-marketing program, or the AppExchange marketing program, I think it's been renamed a few times, but where you can partner with Salesforce to promote your listing. Were you all taking advantage of any of those, or was it all just organic people finding you through the AppExchange search?
I mean, the key thing is to make sure that, like, you show up for the right keywords and that, you know, it's very clear from the beginning, like, what you do. And we struggled a little bit with that in the beginning because I mentioned, you know, it was kind of this general purpose rules engine, and it was hard to say, okay, it's just a lead assignment product. But if you're on AppExchange, that's what you need to do. Like, you know, if you need to, you can create multiple listings potentially, and target each one towards a specific application, but it cannot be like a wishy-washy and kind of half in between thing. It has to target a specific use case, and everything has to be focused on that. And that's the only way that it really works. So the AMP program, we did a few, I wouldn't say it was a resounding success. Yeah, not sure if that's the fault of the program or the way that we did it, but that didn't really clearly translate into revenue for us. But that was later in the life of the company, so maybe kind of the impact of AppExchange had already started to wane a little bit.
Are there any other lessons you learned along the way? Any lessons you learned the hard way, maybe I should say, experiments you ran that didn't really go the way you had hoped?
I think that the key thing is the focus, and, you know, even if you think that, you know, your product can be used for many different things, you cannot position it that way on AppExchange, because you have such a limited amount of real estate. Like, on a website, you have a little bit more flexibility. You can potentially do different landing pages or whatever, but even then it's hard. So it's better to really ruthlessly focus, and then you can always kind of expand from there. That can be hard though at the beginning, if you don't really know what the use case is, and you don't want to close the door on other stuff. But the moment you have that kind of clear signal, you really need to do that. Other lessons learned. We might get into this a little bit, but, you know, if you're bootstrapping, you obviously have, you know, fewer resources. And so there's some trade-off there in terms of, you know, the amount of, you know, bandwidth you can throw at problems and the amount of money as well. So I don't really have experience in managing large marketing budgets and where that goes. I would say, you know, if you're going to do anything around Dreamforce, the productive way to do it is without a ton of money is to work with some other vendors, try to organize a little event or something on the side, where at least you can invite people to come over. You know, you have some presence, you have a specific spot where you can tell people to come and meet you rather than saying, well, we'll figure it out. which is really hard. I mean, still worthwhile, but it's harder to do. So for much less money, you can still have some sort of presence and actually meet like customers and prospects face to face. That's easier if you do it together with other vendors as well.
Yeah, that's smart. Partnering up when the budget isn't there, that's just kind of a clever way of stretching those dollars further. So, yeah. Were there any other partnerships that y'all utilized to, you know, like working with SI vendors, for instance, for implementing your application, or?
For decision on demand, we were never like able to get that to work fully. I think, you know, in part because our product was a little bit niche and more focused on the more complex implementation, so the volumes were not high enough to really train SI partners. You know, we did work, you know, productively with SIs that were incumbent, and that sometimes led to some follow-up business, but it was never like a formal thing. Same thing for working with Salesforce. You know, some deals would come in through Salesforce architects that were looking for solutions and that tried different things. And you know, we worked with them to get into the account and to use the stamp of approval from Salesforce, essentially, to get past the initial trust barriers. Mm. But that also wasn't like a formal thing. It was just like one-off for individual people.
So that was always Salesforce would reach out to y'all. There was no, because I know that's something that's kind of the prize everyone's after oftentimes is getting their app in front of Salesforce AEs and SEs. I think a lot of partners get approved for, get through security review, get their listing up there, and they expect the deals to just pour in their lap from Salesforce.
Yeah. I can't say that I know how to do that. I know some people have success with it. I think the main thing is that it has to be simple. It has to help them, close a deal faster, get over an objection. Yeah. It's not about the compensation that they might get for selling your app. That's really, it's not the main motivator or even a significant motivator. It's really about can you help close a deal that they're working on by taking away a little objection and, as easily as possible. So, we did work on a one-off basis, productively with the Salesforce sales team to do that in some cases, but it was never a scalable thing really.
Sure. I think it's probably all about having those initial early wins when they do reach out to you, and then you can become a trusted vendor, right? I don't know if there is a way to get in front of them otherwise.
Yeah, and it depends on the product. If you have a product that's maybe geared towards the bigger deals and the more complex situations, then by default the volume is going to be much less. If you have something that's in the old days anyway, like a DocuSign or something that, that's just kind of required for every deal with certain type and not done by Salesforce at all, then it would be obvious for them to reach out. For us, we were doing lead assignment and, technically Salesforce does lead assignment, right? Except mm-hmm. that, not really, it doesn't work for anybody and it's a token feature, but the salespeople don't really want to say that during the sales cycle because it's on the data sheet. It does lead assignment. And then there were also a couple other vendors that were already somewhat established when we started. So they had more visibility to the sales team. So that was one reason why for us it didn't work. It doesn't mean that it can't work for other people.
Sure. And so it sounded like you were getting a lot of inbound from the App Exchange, from your website. Were you doing any specific outbound tactics to drive leads and revenue?
For decisions on demand, not as much. Recently we've done more, LinkedIn outbound. We did some outbound email, like I said, the cold email really just asking for advice. So by no means am I a cold email expert, but my takeaway is that what works is really just asking for advice, not trying to sell. The moment people smell a mass email and an unsolicited one and they smell some sort of a sales effort behind it. And same thing is true for LinkedIn outreach. People are happy to connect and even to provide advice and stuff like that. But the moment there's any kind of a sense of you're trying to sell, then the door closes very quickly.
Sure. Yeah, especially now that it's easier for these messages to be blasted out so quickly. I think a lot of people's inboxes are full. So coming with a genuine voice and asking for help rather than dollars, I think probably goes a long way.
Yeah, and then, not only as a tactic, but as a genuine thing, if you really want to learn and, or you want to show people something, but not with the expectation that you're going to be selling to them, And you know, if the product does what it's supposed to do and it solves a problem, then those sales will eventually follow. But you know, trying to sell too hard, especially on a one-to-one basis, hasn't worked for us, let's say, anyway.
Sure. Yeah.
Building an AppExchange business can be isolating. Are you tired of guessing what the right next move is to grow and scale? Don't go it alone. ISV Forge surrounds you with a curated group of fellow ISV founders who are on the same journey. We combine peer accountability with expert-led weekly webinars to help you overcome roadblocks and build a thriving business. Stop guessing and start scaling. Apply for the next cohort today at isvforge.com. That's isvforge.com.
Well, let's talk about a pricing for a minute. How did you land on your initial pricing for, maybe we'll start with decisions on demand. How did you land on your initial pricing, and did it evolve over time at all? And if so, how?
Yes, I'm trying to remember. It's a long time ago, but
sure.
So the pricing model that worked out best was like a per seat licensing, because that kind of aligns with, you know, the way people are used to paying for Salesforce. So it's somewhat predictable, you know, it's not a mental adjustment, and it's, you know, they don't have to try to anticipate like how many transactions they'll try to run or anything like that. It's also easy to manage, easy to measure. Definitely like two things that we learned is, one is, you know, once you're past the immediate need of like, you have to sell something to somebody at any cost, essentially, you know, selling to smaller deals is really not worth it unless you have like a true simple high velocity product, in which case like it should be truly simple and high velocity and low touch. But if you have to get engaged with customers and especially if there's any kind of ongoing support commitment, then those small deals will end up biting you big time, and so you spend almost as much time sometimes with the, you know, with the 5 seats as you do with 1,000, and it's really not worth it.
I've heard that sometimes the bigger players actually expect less support, oftentimes, than some of the smaller deals.
It could be because they have more in-house expertise and are able to do things better and kind of at least, you know, figure out what they're asking before they start asking. Mm-hmm. Whereas the smaller ones, like the moment something goes wrong, it's like they pick up the phone to whoever will answer. And if you're responsive, you pick up the phone, then you're on the hook for doing whatever it is that they want done. And it's, you know, you can't charge them a lot for it, if at all. So it's really, you know, it can be very tedious. And so that doesn't work for a somewhat configurable and configured product. You know, it can work if you know, people just put in a credit card, buy your product, use it entirely by themselves, you know. And it's all like self-service, great. But if it requires any kind of hand-holding, then that's not worth doing. And the second is, you know, don't be afraid to charge higher. Usually once people have kind of, especially for these somewhat bigger deals, if they've gone through the whole process of evaluating a vendor and all that, and you're solving a problem for them, then sometimes even if it's double the price, it really doesn't matter. You know, obviously there's an upper bound to that, but, you know, start higher than you feel comfortable with. And then you can always narrow it down unless you have a very specific competitor that you're facing off against and they do exactly the same thing for a certain price, then obviously that's a constraint. But if it's, again, if there's some configuration and hand-holding and customization, then, charging more for that is often not really a bottleneck.
Sure. I think sometimes for larger companies, they feel more constrained by time than dollars, right? And so if you raise your price a little bit, it's not gonna concern them as much as maybe a smaller organization.
Yeah, exactly. That's not the main issue. Of course, you know, it has to be somewhat reasonable, and they might negotiate, but sometimes the negotiation is performative, so doesn't matter like what the actual number is that you end up with. It's just the percentage that it has to go down. So if you start at your actual price and you still have to go down from there, then, you know, that's, you're eating that. Whereas if you start at double and negotiate down, you can show a lot more flexibility.
You mentioned, you know, that sometimes the smaller deals, they're picking up the phone for support. You also talked about the early days, some of the sales almost turned into consulting projects. How did you draw the line between, you know, this is support that we're going to build out for you, and this is like where our service ends and your in-house team needs to pick it up? How did you prevent, you know, scope creep from what was expected of your team?
Yeah, I mean, that evolved a bit. You know, in the beginning, you know, you're kind of learning and fixing the product as you go along. And so it's fine to do more work than is in scope, because you're building a better product and the customer is being tolerant by letting you do that. Mm-hmm. You know, down the road, you know, it's just standards, like trying to scope out acceptance criteria, assumptions, making sure that, you know, the basic stuff is there, that, you know, you have an environment to work in, you have access to that environment, that, you know, the data is kind of there, and making sure that that's stated as an assumption. So at the very least, you know, you can clearly say, look, you know, it's not our responsibility to create test data for, you know, for your specific use cases, you know, that has to come from you. And yes, it's maybe a little bit of work, but, you know, if you want to test it, then that's what you're going to have to do. You know, if other stuff that is around the product, if you know, you don't have the access to do that, then you don't really want to change anything that is like in the customer Salesforce configuration, because you don't know what the side effects might be. So you really have to build a partnership with both the business users and the IT folks that will be actually deploying it. So, you know, there's a fine line, like, you know, write it down, write your assumptions down and make it clear. But, you know, you have to have some flexibility. You don't want to spend like 3 months creating, you know, the SOW to end all SOWs if that might cost you the deal as well, and plus it's still going to change. You're going to spend time negotiating more, and you don't want to do that either. You want to, you know, be productive, be clear, and build a relationship where it's, you know, it's accepted that, you know, you do your thing, and they're responsible. Customer is responsible for providing the context, and sure. And everybody understands that from the beginning.
Do you have any advice? This is kind of a follow-up to that. Do you have any advice for folks that are receiving a lot of customer feedback and want to make sure they're building still something that has mass market appeal? Because in the early days, when you have only a few voices whispering in your ear, you could misinterpret what is great, a great idea for feature roadmap, when in reality, it's just something that, you know, one or two organizations need. And you could end up pigeonholing your solution for a corner of the market that you don't want to be in.
Yeah, definitely. So one is like, try not to mistake your own ideas of what might be useful for what a customer is actually saying. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, you have to kind of be a little bit visionary in moving things forward. And sometimes, you know, they won't tell you from the beginning exactly what they need, but don't go too far down that, and make sure you have some validation for what you're building, and try to keep it simple. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's a 100% like cut and dried formula. You have to use some judgment, like, does this seem like it's something that, you know, the bulk of customers are gonna benefit from? Or is it really a one-off thing? And mm-hmm. if it's one-off, then try to build a boundary. Like, you know, an AppExchange product can be extensible. You can build in, you know, customization points where you can even add like custom code. Mm-hmm. And initially you can start off And we did this, like we built a fair amount of custom code because the stuff was not in the product. And then over time kind of migrate a lot of that into the product, which, you know, it can be a pain also because, you know, that code, someone has to maintain it. And since you wrote it, you're kind of on the hook for that. And, you know, if you have too many variations of that, it becomes difficult to migrate it back. But if you manage that well, then it can be a good way to quickly, you know, serve your customer today. Learn what works. If you do it two or three times and you're essentially copy pasting the same thing, then, you know, that's a good indication that that it could be a product feature. And you still maintain some sort of a boundary that you don't put too many things in the product that may not ever be you know, be valid for a mass market.
Mm-hmm. That's good advice. I want to transition a bit to team and hiring. We were talking earlier, and you were mentioning that Decisions on Demand had grown to be a remote team. So you were managing how many individuals?
I mean, at the peak, probably like 10, 12.
Okay. Are US-based or just all around the world? Or
all around the world. You know, we had a couple of US-based people to help with customer support and and the sales, and a bunch of offshore developers for building the product and doing QA and some customer bespoke implementation for customers, as well as marketing, building the collateral, etc. So that was US-based.
Any challenge having a remote team like that? It's spread across many time zones?
Yeah, of course. You know, the standard challenges that, you know, involves late night calls often, and there's communication barriers. Mm-hmm. It's hard for for people that are in a different country that don't necessarily, you know, first of all, not 100% understand the culture here, but definitely don't interact with, you know, customers or salespeople or sales ops people on a day-to-day basis to understand like what's important and what's not. So, so you have to bear that in mind. And kind of, I was acting as the product manager more or less, to try to, you know, spec it out in a way that is very clear, but doesn't prescribe too much of the technical implementation as well. Try to establish communication between people and not always be the bottleneck, and not, you know, once people on the team, even in different locations, start talking to each other and helping each other, you know, brainstorming with each other and solving like smaller problems, then, you know, that takes it off your plate. So, definitely encourage that team culture, even if it's remote, and encourage people to talk to each other. So, you know, Slack is obviously great for that.
I was going to say, I bet that was a lot harder back then because that was pre-Slack, you know. So, I mean, these are Skype chats, maybe. I don't know what.
Slack is, I can't remember when exactly Slack came out, but we were definitely early user.
We were using Slack with Decisions on Demand.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay, I didn't realize they were around in 2012.
Well, maybe not at the very beginning. I can't remember exactly when it came out, but once you started having a more distributed team, then definitely most of the communication was all on Slack.
Sure, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, Slack and GitHub, for code, Jira, for tickets. I mean, we had another tool, Assembler, earlier, but moved to Jira at some point.
Well, we talked about a few challenges already, but are there any other main lessons the Decisions on Demand journey taught you and that you're now applying to Sierra AI today?
Yeah, I think I think trying to involve, you know, customer feedback as early as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So decisions on demand, I, you know, mainly started based on a technological or technical, you know, assumption based on your prior experience, and then kind of groped my way towards the use case incrementally, and that took some time, and you know, some you know, unnecessary detours in terms of implementation. So trying to do that better, obviously helps having, you know, had the experience with Salesforce, because I started Business on Demand without any understanding of Salesforce really. I just kind of knew it was a cool platform, but I didn't really know much about how to use it.
Plus now I'd imagine your network in the ecosystem is just that much larger. So finding these pilot users, maybe you could reach into your own network, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. And that there's more, you know, more social validation. So that helps. But really, you know, trying to go after a specific use case with a clear vision, even then, you know, it's still always a triaging thing. And there's a lot of things that you would like to be able to do, but just, you know, don't have the bandwidth to immediately deliver. yeah, and trying to, you know, trying to focus on the marketing and the market presence earlier. So, you know, we spent more time at Sierra AI really establishing a little bit of visibility in the marketplace and reaching out to, you know, influencers and people who can get the word out, get them excited about it. Where it's decision on demand, it was very kind of just App Exchange, and that was about it. So, you know, it's worth getting the message out there. You get a lot of feedback that way. People try out the product. They give you, you know, tell you they don't like this, they don't like that, or they love that. Or the more interaction, the better.
Sure. For anyone listening that is maybe sold on building on the Salesforce ecosystem, but is still kind of thinking about what exactly they should build on it, what do you see as the biggest opportunities for new ISVs entering the ecosystem over the next few years?
Obviously anything related to Agentforce is going to get love from Salesforce. Mm-hmm. And so I think if you can figure out, you know, some killer Agentforce-based use case, and really deliver on that, and that can be any number of things. But I would say something that maybe is not like the most obvious one, because those are pretty saturated already. But something that's specific in a vertical that you know well, and that can immediately generate value without the AI having to be perfect, or without the infrastructure having to, or the data even having to be perfect. But that's just, you know, automating some piece of a workflow that is time consuming and tedious. I mean, that's generally like a good approach to finding use cases to work on. I think personally that, you know, Salesforce, the user experience, both from an end user perspective and an admin consultant perspective, is not the asset of the platform, let's say. And so anything that builds a novel way of interacting with the platform that does not involve going through the default user interfaces. You know, I mentioned we're trying to basically make setup UI obsolete. And I think
a lot
the same
of people will be happy about that.
Hopefully. you know, same is, I think, true for, you know, for the main user interface of Salesforce. You know, few people that I've ever met really love, you know, entering data in Salesforce, especially not salespeople. So AI does offer up many opportunities, and people I know are already working on this, but to interact with the core platform without having to actually physically interact with the user interfaces. So if you can do that, and especially kind of make it super smooth, integrated, you know, so you don't have to retype everything, but into an existing workflow and just kind of make it magically work while the data still ends up in Salesforce in a structured way. You know, there's opportunities there, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. That sounds cool. And even Salesforce is starting, they've been building out more seamless integration with Slack, right, and things like that. So you could be living off platform and still populate that important CRM data into the platform.
Yeah, so, I was at another event the other day, and one of the speakers mentioned pretty interesting insight. I thought that, rather than trying to make the existing process smoother, kind of think about how can AI really kind of prevent the need for the process in the first place. So like rather than like automating the resolution of a support ticket, basically anticipate that something might be going wrong and give users advice or even just do the thing for them so that there's no need for a support ticket in the first place. And there's a lot of, I think, opportunities to really kind of step back and say, okay, how can we be more proactive? How can the AI be more proactive and not just supportive?
Sure.
Or even agentic. So,
sort of preventative medicine type mentality.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, don't even let it go wrong, or don't even let this task become a task that somebody has to do. Just, you know, just do it. And there's some stuff that's emerging already. Like, you know, there's integration between note-taker apps and tools like HubSpot, where tasks just automatically appear if they've been, you know, listed as action items in a call transcript. So a lot more like that is probably going to happen, the sales side as well.
Well, okay, that's interesting. I also wanted to ask if you could go back and talk to yourself before you were starting Decisions on Demand, or perhaps just from the frame of mind of talking to an early founder now, what's one thing they should know or you wish you had known before embarking on the ISV journey with Salesforce?
So I guess it's important to know that, you know, everything always takes longer than you think it will take. The other thing that's important is, like, if you are building, you know, as you are building, you will find, if as long as you're a little bit open to, you know, feedback and as long as you're working with actual people who are trying to use your product or using your product, you will eventually end up building something that is, that is useful and has an audience, and people will enjoy, you know, using that product. So, keep listening and keep, you know, focusing on working with customers as much as possible, as soon as possible, and solving their problems, like, you know, end to end.
Sure.
And then something solid will come out of it. Like, you may not know exactly what it is, don't give up too soon, basically.
Yeah. Staying customer focused makes a lot of sense.
Customer focused and trust that, you know, you'll figure it out as long as you do that.
Yeah. Well, Yella, this has been a joy. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm sure folks want to learn more about you and Sierra AI. So what's the best way for them to learn more about Sierra AI?
All right. The best way is to go to our website, sierra.ai, and click on the book a demo link. There's also a free trial if you want to try the product out. And you can always reach out to me as well, yella@sierra.ai, or on LinkedIn. There's only one Yella van Gunst, I think, that will show up, so easy to find. Hit me up and I'll be happy to chat anytime.
Well, even though there's only one, just in case, we'll link that up in the show notes so people can reach out easily. Well, thank you so much again, and best of luck with Sierra AI.
Well, thanks so much, Scott. It was really great talking to you, and enjoyed the conversation. So thanks again.
Me too. Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Are you looking to connect with the most dedicated founders and builders in the Salesforce ecosystem? The AppAssemblyLine audience is made up of the exact ISV partners and entrepreneurs you're trying to reach. We're opening up a few sponsorship slots to partner with brands that can truly help our listeners succeed. If you're ready to connect with the leaders of the AppExchange, you can learn more at AppAssemblyLine.com/sponsor. That's AppAssemblyLine.com/sponsor.